Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to take a long look at the space program. You know, it's been about 50 years. 50 years when humans walked on the surface of the moon, and we never went back. And now we're going back. And the question is, why? What are the hazards? What are the benefits? Pluses and minuses? Where are we with respect to the space program? I remember what happened 50 years ago, 1969. I remember that year very carefully because I was in the military at that time. The Vietnam War was at its height. The United States was losing over 100 GIs every single week in Vietnam. And I still remember that Life magazine published a picture just of the faces of the GIs that died that week in Vietnam with no commentary, no propaganda, nothing. Just the faces of all those Americans that died that particular week. And of course, they couldn't put the faces of all the Vietnamese people that also died that same time. And I still remember I was at boot camp and we saw the landing on the moon. All of us were glued to the TV set. We saw Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk on the surface of the moon, and it was historic. But here we were, about to potentially sacrifice our lives for a war that we had misgivings about. And we began to realize that on one hand, we were reaching for the stars, but we had feet of clay, and that we were being mired in the quicksand of a war halfway around the world for what? And we were going to have to potentially sacrifice our lives for a cause that we didn't particularly believe in. Well, that was the beginning of the space program for me. However, now it's been 50 years since that epic voyage, and where are we? Well, first of all, you have to realize that today we are entering the second golden age of space travel. So what happened to the first golden age? Well, yeah, we went to the moon, we scored a touchdown, and took our football and went home. Because there was no larger vision to the space program. It was just beat the Russians. Well, we beat the Russians. At what cost? It turns out that in 1966, the amount of money spent on the Apollo space program was 5% of the entire federal budget. That's right, 5% of every dollar that you paid in income tax went to sustaining the Apollo space program. Well, that was unsustainable. And not surprisingly, the manned space program pretty much collapsed as a consequence, and we never went back to the moon as a consequence. A lot of the people who were pushing to go to Mars, well, they felt like they were just holding the bag because the Vietnam War, budget cuts, civil rights movement, unrest in the streets were grabbing all the headlines. But now things have changed 50 years later. First of all, costs have dropped dramatically by a factor of 5, may even go down by a factor of 10. It costs about $10,000 to put anything into outer space in near-Earth orbit. That's your weight in gold, your weight in solid gold. However, prices have now dropped by a factor of 5 because of the introduction of private enterprise. You see, several things happened in that 50-year gap. Former President Barack Obama, first of all, canceled the space shuttle, canceled the replacement for the space shuttle, canceled the moon program, and canceled the Mars program. And he said instead that private enterprise should pick up the slack. It should be a public-private combination of funds that will drive the space program. Well, perhaps he was too successful, because on one hand, we have NASA pushing the SLS booster rocket, fully capable of going to the moon. However, prices have escalated beyond imagination. You see, the SLS was an orphan of the Obama budget cuts. When President Barack Obama cut the budget savagely, it left open an orphan, and that orphan was a booster rocket called the SLS. Well, that booster rocket is a black hole for money. It will cost about $1 billion per launch. I repeat, $1 billion just for each launch of the SLS booster rocket at the rate of, at maximum, one a year. And that's the optimistic scenario. In fact, the New York Times has speculated that the SLS booster rocket may never fly at all. Multi-billion dollars thrown down this rat hole. And for what? Nothing. It may never fly at all. Because we have competition from private enterprise. We have the Falcon Heavy rocket pushed by Elon Musk of SpaceX. They're coming in at a fraction of the cost of the SLS. And they're coming in at a much faster rate. Already, they test-fired their version of the moon rocket, the SLS Heavy, and Elon Musk, just for show, put a sports car in the nose cone of a moon rocket and sent it into outer space. Eventually, that rocket may actually hit Mars with a sports car, a Tesla sports car, in the payload. And so we're talking about a new era of space exploration where NASA may be outgunned by private enterprise. You know, for years, NASA was called the agency to nowhere. Now it wants to go somewhere, but it may do so on the coattails of private enterprise. Yes, the Falcon Heavy missile is a rocket that costs a fraction of the cost of the SLS, and it's reusable. Think for a moment about taking a ride to work and then junking your car. I mean, that's unsustainable, junking your car after just one use. But that's the space program. We junk our rockets after just one use. And that's where SpaceX has come in. They have successfully tested rockets which can take off, go into outer space, and come right back and land on the launch pad, saving a bundle of money in the process. And so we're talking about a new era of space exploration. Private enterprise, unleashed by President Barack Obama, has now taken center stage as Silicon Valley billionaires start to write the agenda. Now, some people say, wait a minute. I mean, these are capitalists. They're not in it for the greater glory of humanity. They want to make a buck. They want to push their egos. And yes, all the above is true. But the question is, well, does the taxpayer want to keep funding the manned space program, costing a bundle of money, when private enterprise can cut down the cost and bring it down by a factor of 5, maybe even 10? Think about that for a moment. And think about the benefits of the space program. You're probably listening to the sound of my voice, compliments of the space program. We take it for granted that we have the internet, we have instantaneous telecommunications, we have weather satellites giving us the weather, GPS giving us the location. I mean, the economy. Much of the world economy is done in outer space. And the benefits are enormous. If you were to stop the space program, you would basically have to stop the world economy as a consequence. But there's a debate going on, a debate that's going on even today, and that is, do we really want to go back to the moon anyway? The current plan is for NASA to send the SLS booster rocket to the moon in 2024 to create a space station, a lunar space station. And then that lunar space station will assemble a rocket that will then go to Mars, perhaps around 2030 or thereafter. However, other people are saying, wait a minute, that's going to delay our Mars mission by a factor of 10 years. Why not skip the moon? After all, the moon has almost no natural resources. For example, we now know what the moon is made of. By analyzing all the moon rocks brought back by the Apollo astronauts, we know that moon rock is almost identical to Earth rock. So, instead of sending a mining operation to the moon to mine copper and other minerals found on the Earth, why not just mine your own backyard and save a bundle of money? Because the moon came from the planet Earth. The Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. Soon after it was created, it was hit by an asteroid called Theia and blew out the moon. The moon is actually made out of Earth rock blown into outer space. So mining the moon is not such a big deal. You can simply mine the minerals in your backyard. Now, the asteroids, that's where you can make a bundle of money, but not by mining the moon. So some people say, why not simply bypass the moon and go on to Mars? Well, this is where private enterprise comes in once again. At the present time, NASA has no Mars rocket. However, private enterprise is racing ahead. SpaceX has its version of a Mars rocket called the BFR, now rechristened the Starship. The BFR was known as the B for big, R for rocket, and F for your imagination. The BFR, the biggest rocket conceived of so far for the space program, now called the Starship. Because you see, Elon Musk, yeah, he's a capitalist. Jeff Bezos, yeah, he's a capitalist. They want to make a buck. But as children, they were thrilled by the idea of going into outer space. They had a vision. NASA's vision was beat the Russians. Well, we did. We beat the Russians, and now we're stuck with a rudderless space program. But you see, Elon Musk has a different kind of vision. He read Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and dreamed of creating a multi-planet civilization. Because, of course, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why the dinosaurs are not here today. Because they didn't have a backup plan. They didn't have plan B. I once interviewed Carl Sagan for Exploration, and I asked him about that. I mean, space travel is awfully expensive. Why should we spend all that money and out of space when we have problems on the planet Earth? And he said the following. The Earth is in the middle of a cosmic shooting gallery. Asteroids come whizzing by the Earth, and we are blissfully unaware of that. One of those days, one of these rocks can hit the Earth, and we could go the way of the dinosaurs. And we should become at least, he said, a two-planet species. We need an insurance policy. We don't need to bankrupt the Earth. We don't need to remove all humans to go into outer space. No. We're talking about a backup plan, a settlement on Mars, in case something bad happens. And the settlement is self-sustaining, so that it's not going to consume valuable resources on the planet Earth. They will have their own agriculture. They'll have their own mining operations. They'll have their own industries. They'll produce things that are of value and can be exported, perhaps back to the planet Earth. And so we're talking about a self-sustaining insurance policy that's not going to corrupt the politics of the planet Earth or suck resources away from the planet Earth. And so Elon Musk has a vision, multi-planet species. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, he has a slightly different vision of the future, not just beat the Russians, not to create a multi-planet species. It's more modest. His vision is to create the Earth as a park, a celestial garden in outer space. Heavy industries would be sent into outer space away from the planet Earth. The Earth itself would become a paradise. Heavy industry pollution is done outside the planet Earth. And he even visions Amazon with drones having a vigorous trade between the Earth and the moon and different kinds of satellites in outer space. He envisions perhaps millions of people living and working in outer space, making a living, raising a family in outer space. Now, you may say to yourself, well, what about weightlessness and things like that? Well, these satellites orbiting the Earth or the moon would spin, creating artificial gravity. And so for the most part, they wouldn't even notice the fact that they are in outer space. They would have their own artificial gravity. And to back it up, these billionaires are helping to foot the bill. That's the point I'm raising. We're not talking about bleeding the U.S. taxpayers dry. No, Elon Musk built the Falcon Heavy by himself and launched it. He didn't get gigantic subsidies from the United States government. And Jeff Bezos has created his own spaceport in Texas. He doesn't launch from Cape Canaveral. He doesn't have to. He has created his own spaceport in Texas, and he wants to launch a sequence of rockets. The first rocket being tested right now is the New Shepard rocket. It looks like a regular rocket, takes you at the edge of outer space, and then lands back on the planet Earth. He envisions space tourism. Now, another billionaire, Richard Branson, has what is called Spaceship Two. It looks like, well, it looks like a jet airplane, goes to the boundary of space, and then comes back. Well, Jeff Bezos' vision is different. It looks like a rocket, but it's luxurious inside. It shoots you into outer space, takes you right to the edge of the atmosphere, and takes you right back. Space tourism at a cost of $200,000 per ticket. Now, that's initially. Prices are going to go down, but right now, for $200,000, you can buy a ticket to the edge of outer space. And for a bit more, you can go to the space station. A ticket to the International Space Station costs on the order of $20 million. How do I know that? I once interviewed for Exploration one of the tourists from Microsoft who went into outer space. He wouldn't give me an exact figure, but he said, yeah, $20 million, that's in the ballpark of what it costs for him, a Microsoft billionaire, to go into outer space. And then Elon Musk of SpaceX, not to be outdone, he's selling tickets to Japanese billionaires to take them to the moon. That's right, you can now commercially buy a ticket to go to the moon. Now, I personally, of course, would have some reservations about buying such a ticket. First of all, I don't have that kind of money. But second of all, yeah, there's a risk. There's a risk involved. Space has dangers. Now, we should also point out that Mars is now in the sights of these billionaires. They think that perhaps the moon is just a stepping stone to the next big jump, which would be the planet Mars. And of course, for that, we need a bigger rocket. Well, Elon Musk has that rocket. It's called the Starship, his latest version of a rocket that is capable of sending people to the planet Mars, bypassing the moon entirely, perhaps beating NASA by 10 years' time. And so we are really talking about a new era in space exploration. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we don't have a traffic jam around the moon. The SLS from NASA, the Falcon Heavy from SpaceX, the new Armstrong rocket from Jeff Bezos's new Blue Origins rocket program, and the Chinese. The Chinese have the Long March rocket, and they fully intend to plant their flag on the moon. Not to mention the fact that maybe the Europeans, maybe the Japanese, maybe the Russians, maybe they may have their version of a space program that'll take us to the moon. Now, I should also point out that other people have looked at outer space and see outer space from a different perspective. The Trump administration has called for a space force. That is the militarization of outer space, which makes people very uneasy. Now, on one hand, it sounds reasonable what the president is saying. I mean, after all, we have an air force. We have a ground force called the United States Army. We have a navy for the oceans. So why not a space force for outer space? Well, it sounds like a good idea on the surface until you begin to think about it. You realize that we are very dependent upon satellites. We control over half the satellites orbiting the planet Earth. and it wouldn't take much to knock them out. It's like two gunslingers, one gunslinger throwing sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding him in the opening shots of a war. That's the danger. You see, the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Who is the most vulnerable to a space war where satellites are sitting ducks to a first strike? We are. We're the most vulnerable because we depend upon outer space for telecommunications, for commerce, for the internet, for GPS, weather satellites, you name it. Probably it's done in outer space. And a country like North Korea, they could put an atomic bomb in one of their rockets, detonate it over, let's say, Kansas, and initiate an electromagnetic pulse capable of blinding us, sending us back a few hundred years into the past. Just one atomic bomb in outer space would release a burst of electromagnetic energy in the form of X-rays that would knock out, 30, 40% of the satellites orbiting the planet Earth. It would also start to knock out power plants on the Earth. We would have massive blackouts, not just in one city, massive blackouts around the entire hemisphere of the planet Earth that's exposed to the nuclear radiation. Satellites would be knocked out, power stations would go down, the economy would come to a halt. For example, I remember when we had a blackout in Midtown Manhattan, and a lot of people, the tourists there, had to sleep in the lobbies of the hotels because all the credit card machines went down. Commerce came to a halt in Times Square. Now, in case of an electromagnetic pulse, you're talking about food riots, because refrigerators would go on the blink. Rescue crews will not come because the rescue crews are also paralyzed because of the blackout. And we have a situation where everything comes to a halt, including the food in your refrigerator. Food riots would begin. So you realize that we are sitting ducks to a preemptive strike if a nation is foolish enough to detonate an atomic bomb over Europe, over the United States, or wherever, because we are totally unprepared for the electromagnetic pulse. Now, you may say to yourself, this is science fiction, right? No, it's actually happened in the past. In 1859, we had the famous Carrington event, where the sun had a temper tantrum, unleashed a huge coronal mass discharge, which hit the planet Earth when electronics was still in its infancy. As a consequence, we saw the northern lights, usually seen in Scandinavia, the northern lights over Cuba. The people of Cuba saw the northern lights because of the massive disruption of the atmosphere. Telegraph wires went down. Fires started in telegraph offices, because, of course, electronics was just beginning in 1859. Could it happen again? Yes, and it will. It will happen because, naturally speaking, the sun unleashes coronal mass discharges all the time. Now, to be fair, most of these coronal mass discharges miss the Earth. It's like a shooting gallery where the sun's sunspots keep on shooting these gigantic balls of plasma into outer space, but space is big. Most of these bullets miss the Earth, but sometimes they hit the Earth. The last time it hit the Earth in a big way, we think, was in the year 775. Massive disruption so big that you can actually pick it up in the geology of the planet Earth. Yes, there was a big one around 775, not to mention the fact that Canada was hit with a partial blow, which knocked out many of their electrical outlets when that happened. And so if a nation were to be stupid enough to start a war, well, that's what you'd do. You'd blind the enemy by detonating a nuclear weapon in outer space. Now, recently, members of Congress commissioned a study to look at the cost of a space force. And they realized that just the bureaucracy, just the paper shuffling, just the bureaucracy of creating a new branch of the military would be huge. It'd be money down the toilet. However, there is a way to police outer space without creating a space force, and that's to revamp the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. At the beginning of the space race, the nations of the world signed the Outer Space Treaty, which had two very important provisions. One, it banned nuclear weapons in outer space. Two, it said the nations cannot claim celestial bodies as their private property. Now it seems so quaint, because you see, most of our Star Wars Buck Rogers type weaponry that the military would love to have is not nuclear. They are non-nuclear devices capable of knocking out satellites one by one. For example, a keg of nails. A barrel full of nails detonated in outer space with dynamite or some explosive could wipe out hundreds of satellites in outer space without nuclear weapons. That's the first thing. The second gap in the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 is the fact that it did not foresee the time when private individuals would be able to go into outer space with their own personal moon rocket. Back in those days, it was thought that only nations, in fact, only the superpowers, were rich enough and technologically advanced enough to put a flag on a celestial body like the moon. Those days are long gone. You realize that Elon Musk by himself launched the Falcon Heavy with a sports car in the nose cone, funded mainly by his own checkbook, a fully functional moon rocket. This was inconceivable back in the 1960s, and so there's another hole in the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. So one of the first things that we can do to strengthen peace in outer space is to revise the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 so that it could prevent a militarization of the heavens. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and you're listening to Exploration. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to rebroadcast an interview with Dr. Robert Zubrin. He's one of the deans of space exploration. He's been like a voice in the wilderness for many a decade, talking about the necessity to go back to the moon and on to the planet Mars. And so once again, we're going to bring on aerospace engineer Dr. Robert Zubrin, founder of the Mars Society, president of the Mars Society as well. And we're going to talk about his vision for space exploration. Is it our destiny to one day be a space-faring civilization? Welcome. This is Dr. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion of space travel. It's been 50 years approximately since we sent astronauts to the moon. Now there's talk about a second golden era of space exploration as costs begin to drop? Well, with us in the second half of exploration is one of the deans of space travel, Dr. Robert Zubrin, aerospace engineer with Rockwell, founder of the Mars Society, and currently president of the Mars Society, with a long history of being involved with the manned exploration of outer space. And today, we're going to run a rebroadcast of an interview we did with Dr. Zubrin, talking about his point of view as we go into outer space, as we go back to the moon, and then on to Mars. The first question for you, Dr. Zubrin, is how did you first get interested in science?
Well, actually, it was Sputnik. I was 5 years old at the time, and I was already reading science fiction. And while to the adult world, Sputnik was a terrifying event, or so I'm told, to me anyway, it was exhilarating, because what it meant was that all these stories I was reading about the spacefaring future were going to become real. And I wanted to be part of it. And so I dug into every science book I could find, and you know, my father got me a telescope when I was 7, and, you know, Kennedy gave his speech committing us to the moon when I was 9, and, you know, during my teen years, we were moving out. We landed on the moon when I was 17, and there was a great adventure underway, and I wanted to be part of that. I think if we were to have a Humans to Mars program today, it would encourage millions of people today to want to enter science.
And I understand you were an aerospace engineer for a while. Could you elaborate, and then how did you go about finding the Mars Society?
Well, I still am an aerospace engineer. That's what I do for a living. I used to work for Martin Marietta and then Lockheed Martin, and then I founded my own company, Pioneer Astronautics, which does technology research and development on contract for NASA and the Air Force. And that's how my source of income. And that's my professional preoccupation. I don't get any money from the Mars Society. But the Mars Society was founded by me and a number of other people who for a long time had believed that the American space program needs a goal, and humans to Mars should be that goal, both for scientific reasons and for inspirational reasons and for societal reasons. You know, I wrote a book called The Case for Mars in 1996. I got 4,000 letters from people who read it from all over the world, asking me all kinds of things, but basically asking, how do we make this happen? And when I showed this to the other folks in what was then called the Mars Underground, we decided the time had come to pull all this talent together and form an organization so that there would be a force in being that could actually try to make humans to Mars happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about Mars as a planet and also Mars from science fiction. If you read all science fiction novels, they do say that Mars is a desert. But they said that this is a desert populated by Tharks and Martians and all sorts of different denizens and aliens. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the geology and atmosphere of Mars.
Okay, well, Mars is a desert today, although as we're now learning, it wasn't always so. It's a frozen desert. It's a polar desert, like what we have in the Canadian Arctic. And in fact, the Mars Society has built a Mars station in the Canadian Arctic to learn how to explore these kinds of environments. It's unlikely that there's life on the Martian surface today, but we can identify places on Mars, and of course the news this week is that we have identified for sure places on the surface of Mars that were once warm and wet and that could have supported life. And that makes Mars really the Rosetta Stone for letting us know whether the conjecture that life originates as a natural development of complexity from chemistry wherever it has acceptable environment, whether that is true or not. If that's true, then life is plentiful in the universe. If it's not true, if there's an element of miraculous chance involved in forming these DNAs and RNAs and all these other very complex molecules, then we could be alone. And Mars is the critical test that's going to let us find out by looking for fossils on the surface of Mars and by drilling down into the ground and reaching groundwater where there might still be extant Martian life today.
Okay, well, for those people who saw Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie Total Recall, they know a little bit about Martian ecology. It's very cold up there, and the atmosphere is very thin.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what would it take for an astronaut to live on Mars, given the fact that it's cold,
The atmosphere is like 1% of the atmospheric pressure of the Earth, and there are huge sandstorms on Mars. So tell us a little bit about what it would like to live on Mars.
Okay. Well, as you point out, the atmospheric pressure on Mars is much too low to allow an unprotected human to walk around on the Martian surface today. So you would have to wear a spacesuit when you went outside. When you're inside, you could be inside of your habitat modules, which are like big tuna cans with life support systems in them, and you would live in them in a shirt-sleeve environment. It's actually, the temperature extremes on Mars are worse than the Earth, but much less bad than the Moon. Actually, on Mars, in the middle of the day, it gets to about 50 Fahrenheit. At night, it might go down to minus 130, so probably be a good idea to stay inside at night. The dust storms on Mars occur periodically, but actually, because the Martian air is so thin, high winds up to 100 miles an hour don't have that much dynamic pressure. The 100-mile-an-hour wind on Mars has about the same force as a 10-mile-an-hour wind on Earth. So they're not really a threat, except if they're happening while you're landing, and then you have a big parachute out, which could be seized by such winds. But if you're on the ground, you could weather them quite easily, and the Viking landers weathered many dust storms without any difficulty at all.
And I understand the gravity is weaker, and the day is about similar to a day on the Earth. So tell us a little bit about what it would be like in terms of a day, the seasons, and the gravity on Mars.
Well, the gravity on Mars is 38% that of Earth. So if you weighed, 100 pounds, you'd weigh 38 pounds on Mars. So that's an advantage. It means that if you're walking around with a big, heavy spacesuit, let's say you weighed 150 pounds and your spacesuit weighs 200 pounds on Earth, you wouldn't be able to walk around in that on Earth. But on Mars, okay, the total mass is 350 pounds, and it would only feel like about 110 pounds. So you would actually feel lighter on Mars, even wearing that spacesuit, than you would if you were on Earth naked. So that's an advantage. The day is 24 hours, 37 minutes long. So it's really just like an Earth day. People can adapt to that quite easily. And it's all one of the things that make Mars attractive for settlement, because you could grow plants in greenhouses lit by natural sunlight, since the diurnal cycle of light and dark would be very similar to Earth. This is, for instance, not the case on the Moon, where you have 14 days of light and 14 days of dark at a time, which is unacceptable to most plants.
Okay, and also tell us a little bit about the water. You said that Mars once upon a time had flowing rivers and perhaps even an ocean, mm-hmm. But what happened?
Well, it's not completely clear what happened, but the dominant theory is as follows. Okay, that Mars in its early history was warm and wet because it had a thick CO2 atmosphere, which made a very strong greenhouse effect on the planet. You know, people are talking about global warming on the Earth due to CO2 emissions from industry. Well, and that can warm a planet because CO2 traps heat. On Mars, you had a much thicker CO2 atmosphere, so much so that even though the planet was farther away from the sun than the Earth, it was still warm enough for liquid water. So a greenhouse effect, bad on Earth, but good on Mars. Now, the problem, though, with Mars is that the planet is too small for plate tectonics. And the reason why this is an issue is the following, that when you have rain, as you did in the early Mars, and you do on Earth, of course, CO2 dissolves readily in water. It gets taken down by the rainwater into the ground, where it reacts readily with rocks to form carbonates. Now, on Earth, those carbonates are recycled back into the atmosphere through the motion of the geology, through plate tectonics, that melts all rocks on timescales of around 100 million years and returns the CO2 back into the biosphere. On Mars, once the stuff gets locked up as carbonates, it's pretty much locked up. So the CO2 atmosphere on Mars started to thin out over time. Now, as it thinned out over time, Mars started to cool because the greenhouse effect got weaker. And when it reaches a certain low temperature, then soil has the capacity to sponge in CO2. Adsorption is what it's called. And once adsorption begins, that thins out the atmosphere much more rapidly than carbonate formation, and you get a runaway icebox effect, where the more CO2 is absorbed, the colder it gets, the more is absorbed, and wham, the whole planet freezes up. And it's been in deep freeze now for perhaps 3 billion years.
Dr. Zubrin, some scientists have said that there is the potential of creating an artificial greenhouse effect on the red planet, which would then raise the temperatures on Mars. Could you elaborate?
Now, someday, human settlers on Mars, when there's enough of them and they have enough industrial capability, could conceivably set up factories on Mars for producing artificial greenhouse gases like fluorocarbons. You don't want to do chlorofluorocarbons because they destroy ozone, but fluorocarbons don't destroy ozone, but they're very powerful greenhouse gases. And if you produce them and you warm the planet up around 10 degrees C through your own efforts, that would warm the planet enough that CO2 would outgas out of the soil and start adding to your greenhouse effect, and we could raise the planet by 50 degrees centigrade. We could create a Mars whose tropical regions were tropical, and in which there's liquid water on the surface again. And while you couldn't breathe that atmosphere because it'd be almost all CO2, plants could, and you could put plants on the ground outside. There'd be rain. There'd be water cycling, and you could start to green Mars. It'd be a tremendous accomplishment of positive environmental engineering.
Okay. Well, also, tell us about the ice caps of Mars. Some people think that some of the water snowed on the ice caps. Other people think that the water is still there underground in the permafrost. Could you elaborate?
Yes. Well, there is water on Mars and almost undoubtedly in both of those locations. We can see the northern polar ice cap on Mars is water ice. And it looks like people thought the southern ice cap might have been mostly CO2 ice, but measurements that we've taken from our orbiters indicate that it's at least 60% water ice as well, and possibly all water ice. And then we can see geologic features that look like water bursting out of the sides of craters in the geologically recent period, which means there has to be subsurface aquifers of liquid water that occasionally break loose. So that's one reason why you really want to send human explorers to Mars, because if we're going to find life on Mars, actual living organisms, not just fossils, we're going to have to set up drilling rigs and reach that groundwater. Then you want to take that water into your habitat on Mars, throw it into bacterial culture medium, see if anything grows. If it does, image it in your microscopes, test it with biochemical testing. See what it's like. See if it mimics the biochemistry of Earth life or if it's something different. This is something we really want to know. We really want to know if all life as it is in the universe is the same as Earth life, since all Earth life is biochemically the same. We all use the same amino acids and the same RNA and DNA method of transmitting information. Or are there other methods of creating life? One of the fundamental questions in science today, and the way we're going to resolve it is by going to Mars.
Well, we don't see any liquid water on Mars today, but some people think that perhaps there could be underground geysers or underground hot springs due to volcanic activity, in which case there could be pockets of liquid water even today. But what are your thoughts?
Well, as I said, the geomorphological evidence is that there is underground liquid water on Mars today. Because the Mars Global Surveyor orbiter took pictures from orbit that showed channels that had been cut out from the sides of craters from water bursting out from the sides. And these things are totally uncratered themselves, which means they happened in the past few million years, which is basically, from the geological point of view, today. So if water could burst out of the side of a crater 4 million years ago, it could do it tomorrow. And that means there has to be liquid water underground on Mars now.
Okay, now let's talk about the robotic exploration of Mars. Some scientists have called Mars the death planet because so many Mars missions have failed. However, we now have rovers on the surface of Mars looking at rock formations. What have they found specifically that has excited the imagination of scientists, the two rovers on Mars?
Okay, well, let me just point out that 12 out of 16 American spacecraft sent to Mars have succeeded. Okay, 4 out of 5 of our landers have succeeded. The reason why the Mars statistics are so low is because the Russians sent 14 spacecraft to Mars and all of theirs failed. But in terms of our own record with regard to Mars, we're batting around 700. Now, what have we found? Okay, well, from orbit, we have found water erosion features all over the place, dry riverbeds, dry lake beds, what looks like perhaps the basin of a dried-up northern ocean. On the ground, what we just found this week is that these water features were not created by water that was just there in some flash floods that lasted an afternoon and then the water was gone, which is what some people had been suggesting. But rather, this water was there for a long period of time. We found what the Opportunity rover has found are what's called evaporites, that is, residues left when water evaporates and the salts in the water and the sulfates in the water have been left behind. This requires standing bodies of water that exist for long periods of time and stay in place long enough for the water to evaporate away. And what's very conclusive, what we've learned from these robots, is there have been places on Mars where life could have developed. And now the key question is, did it?
Okay, now let's talk about the practical implications of sending men to Mars, as advocated by President George W. Bush. First of all, let me play devil's advocate. Let's talk about cost. We know we could do it. We just put enough money into it, throw money at it, and we could put men on Mars. George Bush Sr., when he proposed a manned mission to Mars, numbers that were being thrown out were on the order of $500 billion. What do you think it would cost under your program to put men on Mars?
I think we could have people on Mars within 10 years for $40 to $50 billion. The issue here is actually constraining the problem in the way President Kennedy did with Apollo, where you put a timeline on it, and you say, you've got to do this within a decade. And so you don't just launch a plethora of programs and say, well, you know, this might be useful for someday in the future when people go to the moon or to Mars, and this might be useful. Instead, you sit down, you design an end-to-end plan for how to do it, you design a coherent set of hardware elements to implement that plan, you develop those hardware elements and the associated technologies and no others, you build them, and you fly the mission. If you do that, you can be on Mars in a decade. If you don't do that, you can spend any amount of money you like, and you can spend decade after decade, and you'll have no progress at all. And this is the difference between the NASA of the Apollo period, of the basically from 61 to 73, and the NASA of the three decades since. It may startle people to learn that NASA's budget this year is something like 94% of what its average budget was during the Apollo period in real inflation-adjusted dollars. That is, the average Apollo period budget in today's money was $17 billion a year. NASA's budget this year is $16 billion. And we've spent as much money in NASA between 1990 and today as we did between 61 and 73. But in that earlier period, we developed all the space technologies we have and that we use, and we sent people to the moon, and we sent 40 lunar and planetary probes out. In the period between 1990 and today, we developed no new space technologies. We did not fly anyone to the moon or anywhere like that, and we flew maybe, what, 7 or 8 planetary probes. So when you actually have a goal and you force the organization to address that goal rather than use that goal as a rationale for doing whatever it pleases to do, except for the goal, you can really accomplish something.
Okay, now one of your plans, which is controversial, is to give our astronauts a one-way ticket to Mars, have them develop rocket fuel themselves for the return trip. So tell us a little bit about how that is done in order to reduce costs.
Okay, this is known as the Mars Direct Plan, and it's explained at length in my book, The Case for Mars. The way this works is you do this mission with two launches of a heavy lift launch vehicle of equal capability to the Saturn V moon rockets that we used in the 60s. The first rocket shoots to Mars an Earth return vehicle with no one in it. Now that goes out and that lands on Mars. Then you run a pump and you suck in the Martian air, which is mostly carbon dioxide gas. You react that carbon dioxide with a small amount of hydrogen that you brought from Earth to produce a large supply of methane oxygen rocket propellant. So now you have a fully fueled Earth return vehicle sitting waiting for you on the surface of Mars. Once that is done, then you launch the crew out to Mars with the second rocket. Okay? Now, because the return ride is waiting for them on the surface of Mars, they don't need to fly to Mars in a gigantic Battlestar Galactica spaceship that nobody knows how to build. Okay? They can just fly to Mars in a basic habitation module, like a big tuna can, flies out to Mars. It takes 6 months to get to Mars with chemical propulsion. We do not need nuclear propulsion to get to Mars in 6 months. Mars Odyssey did it in 2001. in 6 months. We can get there right now with this. We go to Mars. We land near the Earth return vehicle. We use the same habitat that we used as our ship to go to Mars to be our house on Mars for a year and a half while we explore the planet. And then at the end of that time, we get in the Earth return vehicle and we fly back to Earth. We leave the habitat behind on Mars. So each time you do this, you add another habitat to the base. And before long, you've built up the beginning of the first human settlement on a new world. There is nothing in this that is beyond our technology, and I might add that the risk associated with this plan is much lower than that of the conventional mission, because the conventional mission involves extremely complex on-orbit assembly of mega spacecraft, which has much lower quality control than you can ever have on the ground at the Cape, integrating the much smaller spacecraft that are required for this mission. And furthermore, the return vehicle has already been landed on Mars before you leave Earth, and that's actually safer than the conventional mission in which you attempt to land on Mars in the vehicle that you hope to take off from. In other words, here you know before you've even left Earth that you already have an ascent vehicle that has survived the trauma of landing on Mars. In the other mission plan, you don't. So this plan is doable with our technology. It's much less costly than the standard plan. It's much less risky than the standard plan. It accomplishes a lot more science than the standard plan because all the crew is on Mars. No one is left in orbit. We've got the technology to do it. So all it takes is some vision, some guts, and a little bit of moxie.
Okay. Well, I was watching CNN television the other day, and the commentator said, well, the Mars rover is going on Mars, but what did it find? Rocks. Rocks, rocks, and more rocks. And what he was implying, therefore, is that there's really not a pot of gold out there. There's really no reason to spend any more money on the mission to Mars. So let me ask you a question. What are the economic benefits? Why go to Mars if it's an enormous amount of money for a goal that is a little bit dubious?
Well, the goal is not dubious at all. And saying there's nothing on Mars but rocks is like saying in 1600, there's nothing in North America but trees and animals. I mean, it's an extremely anti-intellectual and stupid statement. What there is on Mars is a world. It is a planet with a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together. And it has on it all the resources needed to support life and therefore potentially human civilization. And if we can go to Mars and develop the technology that allow human beings to be self-sufficient in this environment, as, you know, previous generations of our ancestors, starting from those who left Africa to take on Ice Age Europe, did. Human beings have used their creativity to master environments that were previously considered uninhabitable. If we can do this, then we can create the conditions whereby new branches of human civilization can develop on Mars. 500 years from now, if we do this, and people look back on our time, okay, they will consider this the most important thing we have done. No one 500 years from now will remember who was in power in Iraq or Bosnia. Okay, probably no one will have even have heard of those countries. But what we did to make the transformation of humanity into a spacefaring species, a multi-planet species with basically the infinite resources of the cosmos open to it, that will be remembered and that will be celebrated.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Zubrin, former aerospace engineer, founder of the Mars Society, and perhaps the country's leading proponent to put men on the red planet. Now, I should also point out that in my personal point of view, I think that robots, especially for the short term, are much more efficient. They don't cost much. They don't have to come back. They don't complain. And they have given us an ocean of data about the universe. The manned space program, to be fair, has not given us that much scientific data, except perhaps for moon rocks from the lunar mission to the moon. However, in the main, robots have given us the vast majority of information concerning the cosmos. That said, however, I also believe in the words of the late Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan once said that we should be a two-planet species. In other words, at some point, we're going to have to leave the Earth. The Earth is too dangerous. On a scale of 5 billion years, the sun itself will eat up the Earth. On a scale of perhaps 50 million years, we could have another comet or meteor that could destroy all life on the planet. And on a scale of just 10,000 years, we could have another ice age. So in other words, it's good to have an insurance policy, but what's the rush? I think in the future, the cost of space travel will go down dramatically. And at that point, the manned exploration of outer space won't break the bank. Now, let me explain. To put a pound of anything into orbit around the Earth, just orbiting around the Earth, costs about $10,000. That's your weight in gold. So think of your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you in orbit around the Earth. To put you on the moon costs about 10 times that, or about $100,000 a pound to put you on the moon. But to put you on Mars would cost perhaps $1 million per pound. So think of your body weight made out of solid diamonds. Every piece of your body made out of diamonds, and then you begin to understand the sheer cost of putting men on the red planet. However, in the coming decades, and maybe in the coming centuries, the cost of space travel will dramatically drop because of new propulsion systems, perhaps a space elevator. And at that point, the cosmos will really open up to human exploration. Now, some people say free enterprise and capitalism in the form of space tourism will drive humans into outer space very cheaply. However, on exploration, we've interviewed quite a few proponents of space tourism, and they admit that the cost of going into outer space will always be expensive because of the cost of rocket fuel and the infrastructure necessary to put passengers into outer space. Perhaps space tourism may reduce the cost to a factor of 10. So it would only cost about $1,000 a pound to put you into orbit. So going into outer space would not be for the average middle-class person. It would cost as much as a house for the average person to go into outer space. So we still have to wait for new technologies to drive down the cost of space travel even farther so that the average person can then begin to access outer space, and not just millionaires going to the International Space Station at $20 million a pop.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this has been Exploration. And our special guest today was one of the deans of space exploration, Dr. Robert Zubrin, founder of the Mars Society and current president of the Mars Society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.